The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 364, The Pursuit of Happiness, Where Do Gay Mormons Go After They Come Out?, a paper by Tom Matthews. The chair to this session is N. Michael Chase. This is a 60-minute presentation recorded on a 90-minute tape. The second half of Site 2 will be blank.
Oh, okay. All right. Good afternoon, and welcome to Sunstone. My name is Michael Chase, and this afternoon's session is The Pursuit of Happiness, Where Do Gay Mormons Go When They Come Out? And it's being presented by Tom Matthews, Associate Professor of Spanish at Weber State University. Before his associate professorship at Weber State that began in 96, Tom Matthews was Assistant Professor of Spanish at BYU from 91 to 96, leaving in 96 of his own accord. And prior to that time, he taught at the University of Utah. Tom served his LDS mission in Spain from 1975 to 77, in Catalonia and Galicia and Madrid. He's been out of the closet for the past 3 years and is still relatively active in the church and is out at his ward. In conjunction with National Coming Out Day last year, Tom presented The Pursuit of Happiness, What's There to Do After We Come Out?, co-sponsored by Wasatch Affirmation and the Weber State Lambda Sappho Union at Weber State. He spoke at the annual Family Fellowship Conference in 96 and has spoken at Illinois State University. And this past April, he presented his Coming Out in Utah, The Story of a Late Bloomer, to the Delta Lambda Sappho Union in Weber State. He's a member of the American Council for the Teaching of Foreign Languages, as well as the Utah Foreign Language Association and the American Association of Teachers of Spanish and Portuguese. And now, here's Tom Matthews.
Okay. Yes, I can tell that's working. The purpose of my talk this afternoon is to talk about some of the options available to gay and lesbian Mormons. I guess the primary principal option is to come out of the closet. I'd like to talk this afternoon about some of the options that face gay Mormons after they come out of the closet. I read something a few months ago in a book edited by Bruce Bauer in an article by Daniel Mendelsohn, and he wrote, quote, "You can't pursue happiness in the dark," end quote. He was writing specifically about coming out, and he was also writing about gay rights in general. And the comment that, at least in New York, he hears often, that gay rights have to do with the right gym and the right bar and the right outfit. His argument is that gay bars and other places where gays congregate are often as dark and as stifling as the closet itself. And that's why he says you can't pursue happiness in the dark. Many people, particularly straight people, have come to think of coming out of the closet as a one-day, one-time event. The fact that we celebrate National Coming Out Day every fall only reinforces that idea. I myself came out of the closet rather publicly on National Coming Out Day, October 11th, 1996, 1995, though not necessarily by choice. On that day, there was a blurb in USA Today, as well as several local Utah papers, announcing that I, a BYU professor, was gay. I had started a more personal journey out of the closet quite some time before that. Some people comment that once you're out, you still have to come out all the time. And I often wear this little rainbow flag in classes. A couple of students sometime back, sitting in the back of my class, I was walking around doing exercises in Spanish, asked me what that flag was. And I said, well, that's a flag that represents gay pride. If I had said that at BYU, their mouths would have opened wide, their jaws would have hit the floor. At Weber State, where I work now, it was, oh, we thought maybe that was the flag of Spain. And they thought nothing else about it. It is true, though, that once a gay or lesbian person has come out of the closet, you have to re-announce yourself from time to time forever. I see coming out something like peeling an onion, something between a one-day experience and a lifelong experience. It happens layer by layer, and it takes time, but it does get done. As I've talked about coming out as either a one-time or a day-long, a one-day-long or a lifetime-long process, I'm really introducing the theme of this talk today, and that is continuum. I don't think coming out is necessarily most healthy as a one-day thing, nor is it most healthy as a lifelong incremental process. I think there's a happy ground in between. I'm going to talk today about several continua. People distribute themselves along the line of a continuum. We're familiar with a lot of them, and I'll mention several that deal particularly with homosexuality. First, I'd like to talk rather briefly about how I came out myself. Years ago, I was a student at Weber State University, where I now teach. I graduated from Weber State. I was an LDS missionary in Spain, and when I came back, my parents had moved to beautiful Ogden, which is growing on me, actually. I went to Weber, therefore, graduated in Spanish. I really liked Weber as a school, and I still do, but it was at that point in my life that I was coming to grips with this whole homosexuality thing. I went to the Weber State Library and looked up homosexuality in the card catalog, and it didn't say very much. I found a few books. Most of them weren't very interesting. Most of them said that I was evil and was going to hell. Even scientific books seemed to say that I was mentally ill and was going to hell. I found one book that I really liked, and I brought it as a visual aid. Alfred Kinsey et al., Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. And I ate this book up. It's fascinating. Has pictures. As you can see, lots of graphs and exciting things. Ages of pre-adolescent orgasm, relation and age of marital status to total intercourse, solid lines. Just amazing. I loved this book. I read it thoroughly. Kinsey came up with a continuum, and he was one of the first sexologists to do that. He was one of the first sexologists ever. But he was one of the first to deal with homosexuality in specific, and certainly the first to come up with a continuum to describe homosexuality. A lot of people have badmouthed his work in the last 50 years. This book was published in 1948. I dare say this is not the same example that I got out of the library. I didn't steal it. I bought this at Sam Weller, I think. At the time, however, 50 years ago, what Kinsey was doing was rather cutting edge. Kinsey realized that in terms of social sciences, we can only talk about what we can measure. And we can't measure what people think. At least 50 years ago, we can't measure how people feel. We can only measure what people do. Today, we've got ways we think of measuring feelings and thoughts and fantasies. But Kinsey would merely count how often people had sex and with whom they had sex and quantify it in that way. When he talked about the homosexual, which he always referred to as the homosexual, he was not referring to a homosexual person, but rather the sexual outlet for homosexual behavior. He described as a zero a man who has never had sex ever in his life with another man. So far as the homosexual is concerned, he's a zero. Some people mistakenly interpreted Kinsey's scale, and still do, to mean that a zero is a man who is exclusively heterosexual. That's not true. A zero, according to Kinsey, is a man who has never had sexual relations with another man. He may have sexual relations with women, with horses, with himself. Doesn't matter. As far as the homosexual is concerned, he's a zero. This makes sense, because to say that someone on a homosexuality scale is a zero does not therefore imply that this person is a heterosexual, okay? And needn't imply that. To say that someone is a zero on a heterosexual scale does not imply that that person is homosexual. It just means this person has never had sex with anybody of the opposite sex. I'm a six on the Kinsey scale. This is a very typical continuum. Kinsey, I think, only made one big mistake, and that was he put his continuum on a bell curve. Back in the 40s and 50s, it was thought that all naturally occurring phenomenon occurred on a bell curve. A bell curve, I'll draw one for you. looks like a bell. At this end, we have Kinsey zeros. At this end, we have Kinsey sixes. And therefore, Kinsey assumed that the average man in the United States had just about as much sex with men in his life as he did with women in his life. The average man, according to Kinsey, if you pick him out of the population, is a bisexual. People have battered that quote around for a long time, too, particularly bisexuals who want to feel themselves normal. In the social sciences, when I say normal, I don't mean anything judgmental. I mean right in here. That's the norm. Kinsey, I should mention also, 3 years later, came out with a book called Sexuality in the Human Female. And no offense, but it's just boring. There's nothing interesting in it at all. There is a second kind of curve, and it's called a U-curve or a bipolar curve, which looks like that. And that would be one end down here, the other end up here, and the majority of the population finds itself at one end or the other, with relatively few individuals in the middle. Normal on those curves means clustering towards the ends. I never realized that that was a possibility when I read Kinsey when I was in college. I didn't realize that it was a possibility until long after I graduate from college and stopped reading Kinsey. I'm a Kinsey 6. And even reading his book on female sexuality did nothing for me. Reading his book on male sexuality still identified me as abnormal and in the fringes. Coming out for me, and I think for many people, happened in two stages. First, it was a self-realization, which for me took a very, very long time. And then many years later, I came to the realization that coming out to my family and coming out publicly would be the best thing for me. So far, I've commented on a couple of continua: how out a person can be and how homosexual or not a person can be. Recently, most of the literature on homosexuality is starting to describe sexual behavior also in a U-curve instead of Kinsey's old bell curve. Dean Hamer and Simon LeVay and others have argued that most people are either heterosexual or homosexual, with relatively few people falling in between. The majority state unequivocally, "I am gay," or "no, I'm not." Some time ago, I got an anonymous email message. I could tell that the person writing the message was a librarian from his email address. Otherwise, I knew nothing about him, and he used an alias. I'll call him Mark. He was reaching out. He'd read about me in the newspaper. He'd never had any contact with any, quote, gay community, end quote. He'd seen my name in the paper, looked up my email address. He suggested that gay Mormons exist along a continuum, with Evergreen at one end. Evergreen believes in reformation, reclamation, and repair, and groups like Reconciliation and Family Fellowship somewhere in the middle, and Affirmation at the other end. He wanted my opinion on the matter. I came to learn that Mark was a completely closeted and married homosexual man who had never been part of any of these groups he mentioned, but that he believed that Evergreen was a good group and Affirmation was a bad group. I did share my opinion with him, and since then, these thoughts have developed into what I'll show with you tonight, or this afternoon. It's a very common misconception to conclude that the poles of a continuum of either sort represent good and bad, or that any judgment at all can be made. One very obvious sexual continuum is physiological and chromosomal sex. People, of course, fall out on this continuum in a textbook U-shaped curve. The vast majority of humans are either undeniably male or undeniably female. The intersex states, that is, chromosomal females that look like males or vice versa, are statistically rare, but common enough to let us define sex as a continuum. Otherwise, it would just be an either-or proposition. There are lots of people who fall somewhere between being a boy and a girl. After birth, the doctors say, "Well, we think you had a girl, but we need to do some snipping." Or, "Pick a name now and we'll straighten it all out later." Although we have a good bipolar distribution on a continuum, this is not a basis for us to say that one end of the continuum, either male or female, is good and the other end is bad. Certainly, culturally, a lot of people do exactly that. One end is superior to the other. I don't think there's any basis for it. Other continua that are commonly used in discussing homosexuality include gender identity. Whether without regard to one's physiological sex, one considers oneself to be a man or a woman. Another continua is sexual orientation, whether one is attracted to individuals of the same or to the opposite sex, or both. The idea of gender roles can also be placed along a continuum in any given culture. For those who comfortably and willingly follow the roles assigned to their sex, or those who rebel against roles imposed on their gender. Our culture certainly has its expectations. If a person is physiologically female, that is two X chromosomes, she should also feel like a woman, act like a woman, and want to have sex with men. Men, of course, should feel manly, act macho, and want to have sex with women. As I said, it's easy to be judgmental, but I don't think it's right. Our culture is very judgmental. You line up the continua and say, you should be here, here, and here. And if you're not, you're a weirdo. Mark, the librarian, in creating a gay Mormon continuum with good guys at one end and bad guys at the other, had made, in my opinion, two mistakes. First, he saw things in terms of black and white. And second, he put everything together on one simple choice, good versus evil. Today, I'd like to talk about three continua that gay and lesbian Mormons find themselves playing with or playing along after they come out of the closet. The first continuum deals with how out a person is and with what community that person identifies. This outness continuum has to do with self-perception and outward identification. At the right end, I picked the ends arbitrarily, we have men or women who are completely out, vehemently proud, and offensively in your face, and will never apologize for who they are, what they think, or how they behave. I make no claim here about the way they do behave. They may be sluts or virgins, but they're completely open and unapologetic about whatever behavior they may have. The other end of this outness continuum, put it down on the left, represent those who are deeply in the closet and have never used the word gay to refer to themselves. They follow Elder Packer's advice and shun the word homosexual, except as an adjective. Following the Evergreen model, they prefer to use acronyms and euphemisms, same-sex attraction, defensive detachment, father hunger, which isn't what you think it is. Or the absurdity presented a few years ago by LDS Social Services, non-gay homosexuals. They look at the flamboyant, pushy, and provocative affirmation of gays at the right end of this continuum and shy away in horror, hoping, pleading, I'm not one of those. Certainly, I'm giving speeches as one of those now, but for a long time I fell into the category of denying it. I really believe that the great majority of gay Mormons begin very far to the closeted left end of this continuum. Slowly, but I think inevitably, we move to the right. Hopefully, only a few lose their moorings completely and bound all the way down to the outrageous activism found at the other end. I say it's outrageous because I think some people define their lives in terms of sexual identity. I don't think that's healthy. I'm a university professor, but I don't completely define my life in terms of being a professor. That would be unhealthy, too. Still, neither end of this outness continuum is a healthy place to be. The fear and self-loathing at one end is no better and no worse than the pride and hedonism at the other. A second continuum describes the moral attitude and spiritual strength of gay Mormons. I use the word spiritual in a Mormon way, and not in an affirmation kind of way. When I say spiritual, I mean what your Aunt Margaret meant by spiritual. At the left end is the morality presented by the LDS Church and espoused and followed more or less faithfully by Evergreen. Quote, all sexual relations outside of marriage are a sin, end quote. Moreover, in their thinking, same-sex affection becomes overtly sexual and therefore offensive much faster than similar heterosexual behavior. Straights are allowed and even encouraged to date, to dance, to hold hands, to cuddle, and to kiss. At this left end of the axis, none of these behaviors is acceptable for homosexual Mormons. Even the evergreen types are not clearly at this far end. I've attended several meetings with evergreen, and there's a lot of fraternal hugging and supposedly proper male bonding going on. At the other end of the spiritual continuum, at the other end of this continuum is moral anarchy and probably atheism. These gay Mormons have lost all belief and faith in the church and in the gospel. Towards the center, there are people who have found the LDS church stifling and yet retain a spiritual sensitivity and desire to worship. They may attend LDS services only rarely or join congregations from more tolerant traditions. Again, in my opinion, neither end is a good place to be. The frustration and sterile loneliness at one end is just as damaging to the soul as the complete lack of purpose and direction at the other. The third continuum I want to talk about is the sexual continuum, which is with whom and how often. The left pole represents total abstinence and virginity, at least as far as same-sex relations are concerned. At the center is a healthy view of human sexuality and a sex life akin to that of a well-behaved heterosexual Mormon. Gays here search for long-committed monogamous relationships. To find that, they date and show appropriate affection, paralleling the courtship of straight Mormons. At the other end is promiscuity and sexual abandon. If it feels good, do it. Any talk of sexual morality or restraint is viewed as a personal value judgment and an uncalled-for condemnation. These people often feel that they will go to hell no matter what, so they might as well have fun getting there. Or they've given up a belief in heaven and hell altogether. Those are the three continuum. One of the major problems with a single continuum, as Mark the Librarian proposed, is that it encourages people to arrive at a simplistic assumption that only tends to reinforce stereotypes. If I collapse all three scales, the outness, the spiritual, and the sexual continuum into one, and then find a gay man who is completely out of the closet and comfortable talking about homosexuality and his own feelings, I will want to place him at the far right end of this single scale, and I will then assume that he is also spiritually dead and sexually promiscuous. This is, of course, absurd. Since my picture appeared in the paper 3 years ago, I've been about as out as a person can get in the state of Utah. Yet I'm closer to the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of sexual experience, and I do still try to keep myself in tune with the Spirit as I work out my relationship with God and with my church. While I was teaching at BYU, I was accused on the radio of being a practicing homosexual. That later got into the newspaper. Not because the speaker, who was president of the BYU Ditto Heads Club, they wanted to be the Rush Limbaugh Club, but at BYU you're not allowed to name a club after any other gods. But it wasn't because he necessarily believed that I was engaging in homosexual acts, but simply because I was talking about my homosexuality. Talking about it meant practicing it. This is an unacceptable conflation in my mind of the gay continuum or the outness continuum and the sexual continuum. Defining gay Mormons along three continua allows for a lot more variation in the community than we can see if we measure everything against just one yardstick. The evergreen types, for example, tend to cluster around the left end of all three continua, not very out, still clinging to a strict Mormon ethic, and aiming for celibacy. Of course, anyone involved in evergreen is evidently out to himself and at least partially out to the community, in that the other members of evergreen and the evergreen chapter know the secret. Although the evergreen members I have talked to represent a wide variation in sexual experience and history, at least at the present, they're hoping to maintain church standards both spiritually and sexually. The people who I know who attend reconciliation meetings cover a rather broad spectrum, particularly in regards to their relative outness and their sexual activity. I might add that the Ogden Reconciliation Group has met several times at my home. Many of the members are still rather closeted. Others are out to the world. Spiritually, they tend to cluster toward the center. They've realized that the church's paradigm for change is not realistic, and thus cracks have formed in their faith in the gospel, and more so in their trust of church leaders. Yet they continue to struggle to fit their acknowledged sexual orientation with their ongoing spiritual feelings and religious heritage. As a member of Affirmation, my experience is that that group, as the only national gay Mormon organization, has members scattered all over the place, not only nationally, physically, but in terms of these continua. They do tend to avoid the evergreen corner, and they tend to be better represented in the out and sexually active side of things. Some are clearly clinging however they can to the faith they have. Others are roundly anti-Mormon. Some are celibate. Others are married in straight relationships. Many seek or are in monogamous same-sex unions. Others jump from one short-lived relationship to another. Some in both reconciliation and affirmation view their sexuality as a gift. Some use that gift liberally. Some are saving it for true love and commitment. Gay Mormondom represents a great deal of diversity. Groups like Affirmation allow us all to come together. Groups like Reconciliation and Evergreen and Family Fellowship show, however, that there is a great deal of diversity. It's comforting me just being with people who have at least some of these things in common, and usually we're quite able to overlook the glaring differences in behavior and belief. I am sure that placement on these three continua is correlated. But I also believe that the three aspects move independently of one another. This allows for the tremendous variety that exists in gay Mormons. Obviously, the most visible among us are those at the right end of all three scales: promiscuous, amoral, and loud. It is sad that the world tends so readily to judge all gays on the sometimes obscene stereotypes presented by those who are merely the most visible. I'm hoping that what I'm saying here is not taken as terribly judgmental of some people, although I am being a little bit judgmental. I could be just as judgmental, if not more so, of heterosexuals, who probably fall out on a similar series of continua. Our society, however, is willing to say heterosexuals aren't all like the ones at the far end. All I'm saying is that homosexuals aren't all like any other homosexuals. There's unity there. It has been argued, though not extensively, that St. Paul may have been a homosexual. I think he would have been a rather latent one. His is the only Christian scripture, ancient or modern, that clearly and definitively seems to denounce homosexuality. But Paul wrote of his, quote, thorn in the flesh, end quote. I believe that our thorns are often the result of an errant belief that spirituality, sexuality, and gay identity can all be conflated to mean the same thing. It is a mistake to believe that spirituality and homosexuality are incompatible, or even that homosexuality and chastity are inconsistent. I think the greatest difficulty the church has had in dealing with homosexuality is its refusal to acknowledge the variety of situations that exist in gay relations. The church has placed all gay men and women on one simple continuum, and therefore assumes that a simple solution to the problem is possible. I know a young man in his 20s, admittedly a virgin, and still completely in the closet to his family and community. He very much treats his homosexuality as a thorn in the flesh. He felt that he could not serve a mission. He finds it quite difficult to go to church. He recognizes that he will probably never be rid of his homosexual feelings, and yet he has a suicidal fear of going to hell. Several times he has wondered aloud if it might be that the church is just right about everything. I worry about him. Frankly, the church has proffered him no help. And as things stand now, I don't think the church will be able to. The church desperately wants all gays to believe blindly and to demonstrate the kind of insipid spirituality that is all too common in most of our sacrament meetings. The church is often quick to excommunicate those who start moving away from that end of the spirituality scale. The common result of excommunication is a tragic retreat to the immoral end of the spirituality continuum. People reason, if the church abandons me, then I will abandon the church. If the church is so very wrong on this issue, then everything the church teaches must be just as wrong. That response, I think, is wrong also. Similarly, the church is fanatical in its crusade to keep gays and lesbians near the chaste end of the sexual continuum. I'm using the word chaste the way your Aunt Margaret used it, too. The church is often ruthless in the excommunication of those who begin to move toward the center. Again, a common result is a slide into sexual debauchery. The church is also quite uncomfortable when we stray from the closet. Homosexuality is a taboo, and no one must ever talk of it. Perhaps I'm making too strong a point here, since the word homosexual, homosexuality, and same-sex attractions have appeared several times in the ensign in the past year or two. But it's been a rather recent change. As gays move toward the self-acceptance and seek help from others, they're told to stop, to keep quiet, and to keep personal things personal. In closing, I'd like to say that coming out for me was the best thing I've ever done. I'm surrounded both at work now and in my family and at church with people who at least have a shot of knowing who I really am. I probably said that in the wrong order, because the level of acceptance is highest in my family, and then at work, and then in my ward. Better yet, however, I don't have to hide anything anymore. Moving out of the closet is an honest move into the light. Going back to the quote at the beginning, you can't pursue happiness in the dark. At the same time, coming out of the closet for me was probably the most frightening thing I've ever done. At the time, I knew it would cost me my job, and it did. I was also afraid it would also cost me the only real relationships I had with people. And with very few exceptions, it didn't. The fear I had that my family would reject me turned out to be irrational, in my case. My other fear was that people would make wide-ranging judgments about me based on one bit of information, and that has happened. With my affirmation that I'm a gay man, people make assumptions about other aspects of my life. That is what I think is at the core of prejudice and stereotype. Many people, when they come out, go through a rebellious stage. If religious constraints have kept them at the spiritual end of things, you go to church 12 hours a week, you shun all homosexual thought and affection, and live a cloistered life with no affection at all. When you finally get rid of all that, you are free to pop down to the other end of the continuum. But eventually, you probably come back and find a life that's meaningful. It has been suggested that it might be nice if people don't come out too publicly until they're done with this rebellious stage. I don't know that I agree with that premise, that people shouldn't come out until we can put a pretty face on everything. We need to see more people coming out at all points, on all three continua. I think we particularly need to see the mass of gay men and women who are in the middle of these continua. I might be making a wrong assumption. I don't have any baseline data. But I'm assuming that most people are in the middle. They might, if we take the three continua and put them together, this is a continua of gay versus straight, and this is gay, then these people all together are going to form a bell curve. I think a empirical question, some social scientist can do a dissertation on it. I think we particularly need to see all these people. These are normal, well-rounded people with all the foibles and all the virtues that most people have. They will be more helpful to any cause than people who have nothing to lose by coming out. Those who have already alienated their community, who have already alienated their family, and whose only friends are already out. This is the problem that Mendelssohn was getting to at the beginning. There's nothing inherently evil about a gay bar, but you're not working on coming out if you're coming out at a gay bar, because everybody there is going to love you no matter what. It's coming out at work, coming out at home, coming out at church that educates. In closing, let me say that I believe the only way to fight the sort of prejudice that comes from ignorance is to come out. I also believe that most of the prejudice aimed at gay and lesbian community by the church is founded in ignorance. I'm a graduate of the University of Delaware. The state of Delaware has a considerable African-American population, about 14%, which is not well represented as the numbers go at the university, which is about 3% African-American. Every year, the University of Delaware had a number of events during African American Awareness Month, which is February, I believe. Once a professor in a sociology class handed out a survey to his students, which in turn handed it out to all kinds of students and faculty all over campus, which asked questions about how many African American friends you had. It asked, have you ever been on a date with an African American? Or, if you're black, have you ever been on a date with a white person? Have you ever eaten in the home of an African-American family? those kinds of things. I was shocked. I had to answer no to every one of the questions. This is not because I'd grown up in a community where there were few possibilities for me. I grew up in Los Angeles. There were lots of opportunities for me to overcome stereotypes, but I'd never gotten out of my racial closet. As you get to know people, you become aware that they are indeed real people. It's for that reason that coming out for everybody is an important thing to do. The recent ads urging gays and lesbians to get reclaimed and cured attempt to simplify the issue. The mere existence of different groups within the LDS community, like Evergreen Reconciliation and Affirmation, tell me that it is not a simple issue. There's a great deal of variety in the gay Mormon population, and thankfully, a variety of directions from which gay individuals and their families can seek support. Let me close by stating that I hope this variety continues to exist. As gay and lesbians find a place on each of these three continua I've mentioned, a cookie-cutter approach to treatment, to support, to anything simply won't work. Anyway, those are the ends of my comments. Do you want to...
We have about 20 minutes for questions, answers. The questions and the answers will come from top.
Or vice versa. Brian.
Do you think a group of gay Mormons that is willing to stay in the church and be out and open and educate, do you think in the long run that will make an impact on the Latter-day community as a whole?
If it happens in one ward, I will. Ryan asked if I believed that if a group of gay and lesbian individuals were more out or open within the LDS community in their ward or in their church, if that would have an overall impact on the church. And if it only happens in one ward, it might not. Certainly, most gays and lesbians in the church know about the Los Angeles Stake, which has a meeting once a month for gay and lesbian members of the Stake. That didn't have a wide-ranging effect. But that's how things start. I have often wondered why some excommunicated members of the church, and I don't say this about all excommunicated, but I know of several people who have been excommunicated, don't just go to church. They were not allowed to go to church, and blah, blah, blah. Well, go. What can they do to you? You'll still be getting to know people. So I think that would be good. I don't know that it's going to make a tremendous change immediately.
I'm not as skeptical as you, but I'm just wondering if people have the courage and the bravery to do that, and say, look, the only time I want to, I have this is the way to do the
church. Well, the comment was that people should go and say what they think, and I think you ended with, I have just as much a right to be a member of this church as anyone else. For better or for worse, you have a bishop and a stake president who get to make that decision. And they may not agree with you. They may agree with you. I have not run into any problems with bishops I've come out to. My current bishop isn't a fan.
I was going to ask in line of what you just said, first question is, would it have an effect on the LDS Church? But what effect would it have on those that are openly gay within their wards, on them emotionally? Because I think it's a pretty rough road to hoe in some instances.
Yeah. The comment was that not only would this have an effect on the church and on a ward, but on the individual coming out. And that's why I don't think we need to have a movement. We don't need to prescribe. If you're going to be a good gay and lesbian Mormon, you have to come out in your ward. The whole point of my talk was there's variety. There are different solutions to different problems. And if I have a major criticism of the LDS Church, it has nothing to do with homosexuality. It has to do with a McDonald's corporate approach to spirituality. During one year, opening exercises in Sunday school and song practice are spiritually uplifting, and therefore we have to do them in every ward in the church. And the next year, it's decided, no, we don't have time for that, so nobody gets to do that. And in my lifetime, that's flip-flopped back and forth several times. Instead of saying, opening exercises in Sunday school and or song practice may be beneficial for your congregation. Decide what you want to do. I would take the same approach to coming out and Gay Mormons. If you feel this will help you, do it. I think the church may. I mean, in some instances, certainly the church is leading to more latitude.
I can share an experience related to your comment. About 5 or 6 years ago, there was an unofficial gay ward at BYU, which is really interesting. It formed around a bishop who two gay students in our ward were thrown out of BYU because somebody was spying on one of their conversations and heard them discussing sexual issues and turned it into standards. The bishop was so angry by this that he went and fought standards. And then after that, I got these guys back in school. And after that, there was a large influx of gay and lesbians in our ward. The ward got to be about a third and one half. And I think it had a pretty strong influence on the straights in the ward, like myself, who, being raised in the 70s and 80s, certainly had my own baggage and prejudice. Thank you.